From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
What really is going to happen, though, is we will now spend more money that could have been spent on education, that could have been spent actually building the roads instead of paying off trial lawyers. Instead, we're going to send the money to them instead of using it for good purposes.
To the representative from Lombard, I would like to make him a broth of Legionella and pump it into the water system of his loved one so that they can be infected, they can be mistreated, they can sit and suffer by getting aspirin instead of being properly treated, and ultimately die.
How dare you take an honest debate about an issue and then wish death on my colleague Peter Breen, his wife, and his two adopted kids.
Representative Kipowit, for what reason do you rise?
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I did want to make a statement and talk about yesterday. I want to offer my sincere apologies to Representative Breen, his family, and the House colleagues for a poor choice of words during a serious discussion on our veterans' health and welfare and safety.
Well, the veto session is concluded. Tempers ran high on the floor of the Illinois House. We'll take a look at what happened this week. Also, since the election, we've been wondering, where is Bruce Rauner? Well, the governor emerged this week for a news conference. We'll discuss what he had to say. That and more coming up. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also with us, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio Statehouse editor, and Jacqueline Driscoll, NPR Illinois reporter. Also joining us today on the panel is Hannah Meisel. She's the political reporter for The Daily Line. And Hannah, good to have you on once again.
Glad to be back.
Let's start with Governor Rauner this week. I want to spend a little time on that. He had his first news conference that we've really had a chance to hear what he had to say since his election loss to J.B. Pritzker. Brian, you were there. What was the mood in the room when the governor came in? It didn't sound as though he had a lot of good things to say about the future of Illinois.
No, he was. He started talking about push he's making on Airbnb, the peer-to-peer house rental company, and whether they have apparently delisted apartments in the disputed West Bank settlement area in Israel. I don't want to go down the whole foreign policy rabbit hole there, but that's where he ostensibly called the news conference about, calling for an investigation to see whether Illinois has any investments in Airbnb. But during the off-topic Q&A that followed that, reporters, you know, wanted to know what his thoughts were on a series of issues, on the election and how voters chose his opponent, J.B. Pritzker, by 15 percentage points and gave the Democrats even bigger majorities in the Illinois House after he had spent 4 years demonizing, 5 years demonizing Speaker Madigan. They asked about President Trump. They asked about whether Republicans should, you know, take the party in a more conservative or more moderate direction. We can talk about all those things in more detail, but basically the main message I came away with is he seems to be trying to, on the one hand, exit gracefully, provide a strong transition to keep government running and you know, aid the Pritzker people in coming into office. But on the other hand, he really seems to have a deep-seated mistrust of this one-party Democratic government structure we're going to have beginning in January. And ultimately, he said he was scared for the people of Illinois in the future.
Yeah, scared for the people of Illinois. Hannah, that seemed to be the statement that I heard from a lot of folks, the takeaway from what the governor had to say that day. And I'm sure there are some people out there who probably agree with him, some Republicans who are worried about what will happen if, you know, with Democrats taking back over, will we see the deficit grow higher, things like that. You know, people are concerned about that, I'm sure. But seemed to be an odd statement, I thought, for the governor to make at a time where you thought, as Brian said, he might try to exit gracefully.
Yeah, you know, I kind of got the sense that he wasn't planning on going that route, but then he, you know, midway through the first question, he decided, well, I might as well go there because I'm being asked. Notable thing, he didn't explicitly mention Mike Madigan, his favorite person, who he had probably mentioned up to, I don't know, dozens, hundreds of times per day near the end of the campaign. But yeah, I mean, like, he has been laying low for the last 3 weeks after the election. I asked him a little bit about the transition procedures. He said that he's very involved, but he also said that he hadn't spoken to J.B. Pritzker since election night, since he called to concede. You know, he was also asked about the future of the Republican Party. I thought that was he gave kind of an interesting answer. He didn't want to give too much. He kept saying, I feel like on three or four answers, he said, you know, I'll have more to say on that in the future, but not right now. But on the future of the Republican Party, he said, you know, we have this chairman, Tim Snyder, who, by the way, Rauner had handpicked to leave the Republican Party, but also just left his Cook County commissioner race earlier this month. But he also said, you know, clearly changes are needed, clearly improvements are needed. He also said that he would be commenting on President Trump in the future, not today. He said, but, you know, that was something that had dogged him persistently. You know, people on the right wanted him to endorse Trump. People on the left were kind of always watching to see if he was going to trip up and accidentally, you know, endorse a policy or something. So he was walking a pretty thin tightrope basically for the last 3 years since Trump emerged on the scene.
Charlie, your thoughts on what the governor had to say?
Well, it kind of struck me as a little bit of sour grapes. You know, well, you guys weren't smart enough to reelect me, so I'm worried about what's going to happen to you, but it's your fault, that kind of an attitude. I think if you look at it objectively, the state suffered during the time that Governor Rauner was in office. Our fiscal position is worse than it was the day he took office. Our social service network, human services for those most in need of help, is still recovering from the effect of that two-year budget impasse. Higher education is suffering. It'll take years to recover. So I would argue that people should have been afraid of another 4 years of Bruce Rauner unless he were to change his tune. And instead of being such a confrontationalist and labeling anybody who didn't agree with him as being corrupt, unless he would have learned how to deal with the majority Democrats, we would be headed down a path where we would be even more scared, so to speak.
To Charlie's point, I think that those of us who have been, whether you've been watching state government for a year or 50 years, if you watch it up close, the way those of us in the press corps have the privilege of doing, you get to see the expertise that people develop, not just in subject areas like criminal justice or energy policy, things like that, but also just in how you deal with other people, how you negotiate compromise, how you win support for your ideas, and also how you can help power your ideas through if they're unpopular. There are ways of doing that. And all of that is a skill. It's a political skill, and it's something that the governor explicitly campaigned on not having as a selling point. And we've certainly seen that's a popular way to campaign. And I think some of us are wondering if he will ever sort of acknowledge that maybe he needed to figure out the politics a little bit more than he did, in terms of not the politics of the retail campaigning and talking to voters and getting elected, but the politics in terms of negotiating compromise inside the building. And why I think this is still a salient point and not just something to think about in terms of the past, but in terms of the future, is because we now have another person who has no previous elected office experience who's going to be our governor. And will he learn those lessons and figure out a way to work with people instead of simply counting on his bully pulpit and his vast wealth to exert his will in the legislature?
And it does sound as though, from Brian, what you'd said earlier, that he is going to maybe let loose at some point on some of these other issues about the Republican Party, about Jeannie Ives, about Donald Trump. We may hear more of that either before he leaves office in just over a month from now, or possibly right after he leaves office. We'll continue to follow that. Let's turn, though, to the legislative session this week, the second week of the Illinois veto session. There were some bills that we've talked about before on this show that were sitting there waiting to be overridden, or at least attempts at that. One of those that did not make it through, did want to mention, was the what's known as Tobacco 21. And this basically would have raised the age for legally purchasing tobacco products from 18 to 21. Jacqueline Driscoll with us. Jacqueline, you covered this. It did not get enough votes to override the governor's veto.
Right. It passed the Senate in the first week of veto session, but the measure would have raised, as you mentioned, the minimum age to buy tobacco products, including e-cigarettes or vaping devices, up to 21. The bill also removed penalties for any minor who was caught in possession of tobacco, but the retailers who violated the law could have been fined. That was an issue that Governor Rauner took with this particular measure, as well as other Republicans. Representative Camille Lilly was the sponsor of this legislation. She's a Democrat from Chicago. She said she knew that it was very highly unlikely that she would garner enough votes to get the 71, the majority required for an override of the veto. But she did want to call the bill to keep the conversation going, she said. And she says she will be back next year with a new bill. It will be very similar. It will also include that provision that would remove penalties for minors, despite the lack of support for that reason. She did say that Pritzker believes in this idea when I spoke with her, but Brian actually reached out to Governor-elect Pritzker's campaign, and he hasn't really made his stance clear. He did say a spokesperson for the campaign for the administration said if it does pass, he'll figure out what's best for Illinois. So we'll be keeping an eye out for that next session.
Well, we do know that a lot of towns out there have already made this move. So this is not an idea that's just coming from the legislature. This is actually coming up from local governments as well. And probably more by the time the legislature takes this up again, more towns will probably pass it. So it seems to have some growing momentum.
Definitely. And this isn't just something we're seeing in Illinois either. The T21, which is what the bill we're seeing across the national landscape, is passing in other states as well.
Well, that was not getting enough votes to pass. Another bill that did get enough votes to be overriding the governor's veto was one that would raise damage awards for those families who had lost loved ones at the Quincy Veterans Home because of the Legionnaires' disease outbreak there. And Hannah, let me ask you about this one. This is what spurred that big comment that was made, getting a lot of attention at the start of the show we played from Representative Kifowit regarding her conversation with Representative Peter Breen. Talk more about that, what the bill's about, and then what led to this whole discussion.
Right. So earlier this year, your colleagues up at WBZ Chicago Public Radio had done a lot of reporting on what exactly went on in 2015, in August 2015, when this outbreak initially killed 13 people at the Quincy Veterans Home. As part of their reporting, they found out that, you know, if someone was going to sue the state over this, it would end up in the Court of Claims. And a 1972 law limited the amount of damages awarded by the Court of Claims to $100,000. So this bill came about ostensibly, you know, targeting this situation, raising the cap from $100,000 to $2 million. However, you know, it's not just limited to the Legionnaires' families' victims. So the Republican, I mean, you know, it wasn't just straight party line, but what floor leader Representative Peter Breen, who actually happened to lose his election earlier this month, his point was that this is opening the state up to a lot more lawsuits. Trial lawyers are going to be more hungry to sue the state now that the award can be up to $2 million. You know, he said it's just fundamentally bad policy for this reason. But then Representative Kifowit, who herself is a Marine Corps veteran, you know, she took offense to his comments saying, you know, it is a bill about the Quincy Veterans Home. It's, you know, it's disgusting what happened under basically Governor Rauner's watch. Then she attempted to make I wonder how you'd feel, only she did not choose her words carefully at all. And she said, as we heard at the top of the show, I'd like to make you a broth of Legionnaires, because that's apparently what had happened was 1,600 gallons of stagnant water had been released into the water supply, and that water was full of Legionnaires bacteria. So yeah, that got ever-present gadfly Republican Jeannie Ives up, and she said, you know, how dare you make a literal death threat to my Republican colleague? This is just another, you know, sign of the Democratic strategy, et cetera, et cetera. Breen himself then got pretty upset. He said off mic, you know, you wish death on my bleeping family. Kifwit then stood up later. She made a half apology, but not really. You know, she said, you know, I think you've misinterpreted my words. And of course, that by her not apologizing right away, it sent it into a second day of media coverage.
And Brian, certainly the media jumped on this. It was, you know, and all the time I've listened to floor debate through the many years I've been there, at least, I thought that was a pretty outlandish thing to say. I'm sure she meant to say it a different way, but it was, you know, but at the same time, tempers are running high because, you know, we've just gone through this election. So everybody's kind of at each other's throat a little bit. You know, what's the takeaway from this? Do we, you know, is this just a bad day basically in the legislature?
Yeah, it is interesting because it's not, I mean, the anger came even though that side has won, right? The Democrats mm-hmm. are going into the next General Assembly with an even bigger majority and with a Democratic governor who espouses more, you know, sort of liberal positions that a lot of Democrats have been pushing for than we've had in a long time. And so that's where I think it seemed unnecessary in one sense. And there was even some reporting I saw, not my own, but that the bill only got the very narrow number of votes, the exact number of votes needed to override the governor, and that there were probably three more votes out there it could have had if this, you know, these comments weren't mm-hmm. made in the way they were. Now, I'm perfectly willing to believe that Representative Kifwit, you know, remembers saying things a little differently, or maybe she, as Hannah said, she said, you know, how would you feel if your family were subject to this? But that is not what she said. And I think that her choosing not to apologize and saying, you know, instead that I think I was misheard, you misunderstood me, and I'm sorry if you misunderstood me. I mean, that sort of thing only serves to exacerbate the problem. And then the next day, when she did finally get up and apologize, the Republicans didn't quite want to let it go, and they, you know, ended up moving to strike her comments from the record. Sort of to get ahead of that, as the House Democrats often do. We ended up sitting around for almost an hour waiting while they were, you know, lots of their attorneys were moving around and doing things. And we later saw that they came out with their own motion to strike the words. So, I mean, this is all a lot of kerfuffle. To get back to one thing Hannah said, though, about Representative Ives and the points she made. And this is a point that Representative Breen made, too. And I think this is an interesting and valid point is that the sort of campaigning that the House Democrats do, if you vote against the budget, right, if you're a Republican who votes against the budget because you don't like, you know, the way generally the Democratic, you know, emphasis on spending and not doing enough cutting, right? If you vote against the budget, there will be mailers used against you in the campaign that say that you stand with rapists and sex offenders because the budget funds, you know, the state's activities to monitor sex offenders, and the budget funds the state's activities to support rape crisis centers. And it's that sort of really nasty campaigning and sort of making these leaps that the Republicans say is out of bounds, even though they've practiced it themselves. But, you know, they say it's out of bounds. And the finances this year were so lopsided towards the Democrats. I think that really stings, and that's sort of the broader point they were trying to make.
And Charlie, your thoughts on it?
Well, as I commented somewhat, I guess, in jest, well, at least no punches were thrown, because I remember occasions where lawmakers take offense and they slug each other. And so this was all rhetorical violence. Yeah, and Kifwit was out of line with her comments. I can understand why she was so upset, because she is a Marine, and there's a saying, once a Marine, always a Marine. And so I think she took what happened at Quincy pretty personally. And this notion that, well, this bill is kind of a sop to the trial lawyers, which was one of the points that Breen was making, she found that very offensive. She should not have said what she did. She should have apologized right away. But as I say, no punches were thrown. You know, no harm, no foul. But to the point that Brian made, the type of campaigning done by both sides is just outrageous. It's lies, it's mistruth, it's distortion, and it's just sickening. And it's, if you're an Illinois citizen trying to actually find out where people stand, what public policy positions are being debated, you have a hard time when you're deluged with all this garbage put out by both sides. This time the Democrats had a monetary advantage, so they could pollute our airwaves and social media more than the Republicans. A couple years ago, it was the Republicans with the monetary advantage with Bruce Rauner's money. So in my mind, I would like to see us get back to where people actually discussed issues and people understood that reasonable people can disagree without being evil or a demon if you're on the other side.
A few more pieces of legislation were overridden by the legislature this week, over vetoes that were overridden. The Voices Act, Jacqueline, was something that got a lot of attention. Can you talk just briefly about what that would do?
Yeah, this measure sets a deadline for processing visa applications to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking. The claims filed by the illegal immigrants give them federal protection if law enforcement says that they did actually come forward and actively cooperate in prosecuting the case. I think it's important to note when and where Governor Rauner initially issued the veto of this bill. It was back in August in Southern Illinois. So this might have been an attempt to get downstate conservatives who support President Trump in his efforts there to get behind his reelection bid. But the House was able to narrowly approve this bill.
Another one that came up this week was known as something that went after what are known as jailhouse snitches. And this is something that has been an issue really for years, including during the whole debate over whether or not Illinois should have a death penalty. So what's this latest legislation do that was, again, overridden by the legislature?
Yep. This legislation requires prosecutors to now disclose their planned use of a jailhouse informant at least 30 days before the trial. They used to be able to do this just days before the trial. They also have to tell defense lawyers what benefits are going to be offered to the jailhouse informant in exchange for their testimony. And they will also have to prove to a judge that the testimony is reliable and admissible in court, because some argue that these informants do have incentives to lie. We've really seen this as a movement across the country, though, to reform this particular practice. And now the Illinois law I was reading is actually widely thought to be one of the strongest now in the country.
And Brian, this has, as I mentioned, has come up before. It has been an issue for a long time. So Illinois, is it just Illinois trying to, you know, crack down a little bit more on this use by prosecutors of the so-called jailhouse snitches? You know, I know they've taken action in the past regarding this.
Yeah, no. So the Illinois Innocence Project, which is part of the University of Illinois Springfield, where our radio station is also based, is one of these groups that vets. They get letters from inmates all the time saying, I was wrongly imprisoned. They do a lot of investigating. They only take the cases that are really, where they really have a strong reason to believe that somebody was improperly convicted. And they spoke to our colleague Sam Dunklaw this week and said that there are at least 17 cases in Illinois where jailhouse informants have been responsible for wrongful convictions. So this is, you know, Illinois has a significant problem over decades now of wrongfully convicting people. And this is, the innocence people say, this has been a big part of it.
Well, before time gets away from us, Hannah, when I think of Chicago aldermen and powerful Chicago aldermen, I think of Ed Burke. And Ed Burke, mm-hmm. this week, certainly well-known in the Chicago area, maybe not as much downstate, but something happened there this week regarding his office. We're still trying to get some information on that as we record this show. But looks as though there was a raid on his offices in Chicago. Give us an update on what's taking place there.
Right. So at about like 10 a.m. Thursday, reporters started noticing that there were brown paper coverings on the inside of Alderman Burke's City Hall offices. Turns out also at his ward office in the 14th Ward. This federal raid, it really seems like the feds wanted to make it public. There are several, you know, different tactics that they could have gone about doing this. But it seems like they have something serious if they're going to make it this public.
And we don't know. And we don't know yet what that might be, right?
No, we don't know. It could be months, weeks, years before we find out. But if they're going to make something this public, it seems like we would find out something maybe sooner rather than later. But yeah, I mean, Ed Burke is a kingmaker. He's been on the city council for 49 years. His wife is Illinois Supreme Court Justice Ann Burke. His brother is now outgoing State Rep Dan Burke. You know, he is a fixture in Chicago Democratic machine politics. And the raid was, I mean, a lot of people were talking about it yesterday. I caught up with Dan Burke outside of the House chamber, you know, right after he found out, you know, and then I caught up with him maybe like 20, 25 minutes later after he had the chance to make some phone calls. And he said, you know, it's, he didn't know what it was, or at least he told me that he didn't know what it was. And he said, you know, it's shocking to have this happen on my last day in the legislature. You know, he's my older brother. He even said, you know, he cooked the turkey last week at Thanksgiving, and he was kind of dumbstruck, I would say.
Okay, we'll continue to follow that. Let's go to our notes from the field. Charlie?
Well, we've been talking about the governor's record on vetoes, and it turns out that he didn't do all that badly in his lame duck session. Between total vetoes and mandatory vetoes, he was overridden on 32 out of 83, so that meant that his position prevailed in 61% of the occasions. A year ago at the end of the first year of the 100th General Assembly, he prevailed 65% of the time.
Okay. Jacqueline.
Illinois consumers are now going to be able to use short-term health insurance plans for only 6 months at a time after overriding the Governor Rauner's veto of a bill that set that limit. Before the bill, federal rules allowed them to be used for a year, and they could be renewed for as long as 3 years. That was a Trump administration change to the rules. So,
okay, Brian?
There was a great story out of the News Gazette in Champaign, Urbana this week. Reporter Tom Kasich, who I understand retired earlier this year, but fortunately is still doing a fair amount of writing for them, had the story of State Representative Clark Robinson Griggs, who most of us, I presume, have never heard of, but is the legislator said to be most responsible for getting the University of Illinois located in Champaign. This involved all kinds of amazing scheming. It kind of reminded me of that movie Lincoln, if you've seen that, and the sort of shenanigans that were going on to get this passed. He ran for speaker in a bid to get, you know, that was a fake bid. He really just wanted control of the committee that would site the university. He took over the Leland Hotel in Springfield and had these sumptuous buffets that people could come and really wined and dined and foisted oysters upon people, and ultimately prevailed on a vote of 67-10. Within a few weeks, the Senate passed it, the governor signed it, and the U of I has been in Champaign-Urbana ever since.
Okay, and Hannah.
The Illinois Prisoner Review Board this week ended up tied 7-7 on whether to parole the Starved Rock State Park killer, which I had never heard of this, but apparently a man named Chester Wegger in 1960 killed three women at Starved Rock. And he is possibly the longest serving prisoner within the Department of Corrections. There are apparently a couple people who had earlier entry dates but had been released and came back in, but he is 79 years old, and it seems like it came down to one absent Prisoner Review Board member who had voted for his release previously.
That will do it for this week's broadcast. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, Jacqueline Driscoll, and Hannah Meisel. Get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and also find us at NPR One. Production assistance for the program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.